From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
There are a lot of innocent people when you shut down the government. Veterans, people on Social Security and the like. I can go through the whole litany of activities of government which would be affected by a shutdown.
That's the U.S. Senator Dick Durbin talking just recently about a vote that he took in the U.S. Senate. It's angered a lot of Democrats. Durbin has had a long and distinguished career. He is the Democratic whip in the Senate, but he's under fire from his own party, and his political future, if he retires, could create a musical chair scenario for those seeking higher office. Also, state lawmakers are hitting the busy season for pushing legislation. We'll discuss that and more coming up on State Week. I'm Sean Crawford in Springfield. Our panel includes Charlie Wheeler, professor emeritus and former director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. Charlie's also been a longtime reporter and observer. And our guest this week is Alex Degman, who covers the State House for WBEZ and Illinois Public Radio stations. Alex, it's good to have you back with us once again.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So, Alex, you were there when Dick Durbin made those comments last week. And for those that haven't followed closely, what has led to this criticism he's suddenly receiving? I guess suddenly makes sense because I hadn't really heard a whole lot more before this. But a lot of Democrats don't seem too happy with him right now. What's going on?
Yeah, well, Dick Durbin was one of a few Democrats in the Senate who voted to end debate on the continuing resolution in the Senate, which essentially funds the federal government for another 6 months. Now, something that has been a little bit lost in all of the coverage in this, and I want to make clear, is that Durbin essentially voted for the continuing resolution. But what happened was he voted to end debate, but then he didn't vote to actually pass the continuing resolution. So once it actually got to the point where people were voting on it, he did vote no. But the fact that it even got to a debate, and he was one of the people that cut off criticism from the left flanks of the party, you're right, that did anger a lot of people. And part of his visit in Taylorville was to defend that decision. And he was pretty consistent when he defended that decision, because Dick Durbin has long been of the mind that shutting down the government is bad. And when you shut down the government, real people are harmed. Real people lose their jobs. Real services stop being provided. So that's not something that he thinks is necessarily something that can be used as a bargaining chip. However, there are people in the Democratic Party who think that this is not necessarily a normal political time. And you can't use normal political conventions in a time like this when you're fighting back against what people say is, you know, creeping authoritarianism. So that's where the left flank of the party is coming from. And that's why they're really mad at Durbin about it. But, you know, like I said, Durbin's been pretty consistent about this. And when asked about, you know, how does this even play itself out in 6 months? How do you pass a budget in a bipartisan manner like you want? I mean, is that even possible in 2025? And his answer was simply, I don't know. We'll see.
Charlie, you followed Durbin. You followed these types of fights for a long time. I guess what's your thought on what happened there in Washington?
I think Durbin approached it from the point of view that, as Alex suggested, if we don't fund the government, a lot of people are going to be hurt. And it's not the people that the Democratic progressives are railing against. It's not the oligarchs of the world. It's going to be the working class folks who are going to lose all kinds of services and protections. And the argument from the other side is, while that is true, allowing the Republicans to go ahead with their continuing resolution, in essence, doesn't really solve the problem, and it just prolongs the suffering into the future, and Trump and his minions are going to continue to gut the federal government to find ways to pay for the tax plan that they want to put forward that's basically not going to help the average working guy. And so The flip side of it is, well, when are you going to take your stand? Are you going to take it now? You're going to take it somewhere down the road? The damage is going to be done one way or the other, and we should make a stand now and maybe see if we can't get something out of it, get some concession from the other side. And my understanding is that there was no kind of a bargain that Durbin and I believe 9 other Democratic senators, Majority Leader Schumer among them, or Minority Leader, rather, Schumer among them, voted to end the filibuster to allow the Republican plan to go forward. there was no concession given to them in terms of, well, we're going to mitigate the damage to the little people that you guys say you're concerned about. So that's the question. And also, I think part of it also is people have made something of Durbin's age. And I'll confess, I am actually older than Dick Durbin by a couple of years. And so I consider my own situation, and I'm not as sharp as I was 20 years ago. And I think that's kind of common for people my age. And maybe it is time to pass the banner on to someone else. I've seen stories and comments that there are people itching to go. And if Durbin doesn't decide one way or the other, well, whatever Durbin decides, they're going to go. And so even if he says, I'm going to run again, he's going to face a primary battle, which will not be at all helpful for the party.
Yeah, Alex, it seems to me that there's certainly a split in the Democratic Party. And as Charlie mentioned, some of it is around age, because I think there is a younger, maybe more progressive wing of the party that seems to be saying, hey, you old folks, look where you got us. You got us Donald Trump.
Well, I think it has a little bit to do with age, and I think it has also a lot to do with ideology. We are seeing in the Democratic Party, and also, I guess, for that matter, the Republican Party, too, to an extent, you're seeing different factions of the party kind of warring over where the party is going to go. And when you have people like Dick Durbin trying to decide whether he's going to run again, I would consider Dick Durbin, you know, very much part of the old guard that some of these younger folks are talking about. So as Dick Durbin tries to make his decision, the younger folks in the party are trying to like coalesce and figure out, okay, what's our next move? And it really, I think it has a lot to do with more ideology than anything.
So Charlie just mentioned that Durbin, we're not sure what his future holds right now, if he's going to run for another term or not. He is 80 years old. He'll be 81 late this year. So he'd be going into a campaign season at 81 for a 6-year term. That's a lot to ask of somebody. But he has not said what he's going to do. I know that question came up when you saw him here in Central Illinois about a week ago. What did he have to say?
Not much. His answer when asked about that was soon. And that is kind of what he's been saying ever since his self-imposed deadline of the first of the year passed. So, you know, I guess we got to take him at his word. It's going to be soon.
And Charlie, you expect if Durbin doesn't run, certainly, maybe you mentioned a primary. He could face a primary if he decides to try for another term. We could also see a primary because there may be more than one Democrat who wants that seat. Wouldn't you agree with that?
Oh, sure. I'm guessing there'd be 5 or 6 Democrats who are ready to do it. I mean, Lieutenant Governor Stratton has already said that if Senator Durbin decides to retire, that she's going to be a candidate for the seat. I think Alexei Janulis is someone else who's made no bones about the fact that he sees Secretary of State's office as a stepping stone to something higher or bigger. And so I'm sure I'm leaving out some people who've been mentioned, but there is no dearth of people who would be glad to step into that role, and they'll be duking it out in the primary. And my guess is if one of them decides to run against Durbin, should he run again, there will be others who join them and will have a real bloodbath. And in the bottom line is Illinois will still be a Democratic seat in the U.S. Senate, but the fallout could hurt other candidates up and down the ballot, particularly in more local races.
Well, those seats do not come open that often. They're 6-year terms, as I mentioned. Doesn't look like Tammy Duckworth's going anywhere right now. So, again, a lot of focus on this, and we'll continue to watch that.
You look at how Duckworth has been so outspoken and made no bones about her argument against the Trump administration and the way in her opinion, it's just ripping apart the fabric of America. And it's crickets from Dick Durbin on this stuff.
You're listening to State Week. I'm Sean Crawford in Springfield, along with Charlie Wheeler and Alex Degman with Illinois Public Radio. Alex, this is that period where legislation starts to either pick up steam or maybe starts to fade a bit. Of course, lawmakers still looking to try to pass a budget before the end of May. But there are a lot of other measures that are out there as well. So let's talk about a few of those. One of those deals with homeschooled children and their parents. And there's an effort at the state to add some more oversight to that. What's being discussed?
Homeschooling in Illinois right now is largely unregulated, and this would be an attempt to regulate it. And as you might imagine, some of the folks who homeschool their kids aren't real pleased about that. So basically what this would do is set a whole bunch of requirements for reporting things to the state. Like, for example, you would need to, if you homeschool your child, you would need to register with your local school district. Just so basically they know that you live in the district and that there is a child there that is being educated. Another thing is they want to make sure that these children are attending school in some way, because there have been a lot of questions in the past about truancy and whether homeschool kids are, you know, attending school to the level that state law requires. If they want to be involved in sports and activities, they have to sign immunization forms and make sure that everything's on file and things like that. So there are a lot of things that are required of homeschool parents in the bill, plus requirements of the homeschool parents themselves. Homeschool parents are going to have to prove that they, you know, at least have a high school diploma. They have to prove that their curriculum meets standards. They're going to have to, you know, do all of these things that right now they just don't necessarily have to do. So part of the reason I think that parents want to homeschool their kids is because they don't want the public school system to be a part of their lives, really. That's why they homeschool. So this is bringing out a lot of people who think that this is just government interference. Everything works fine now. Why do I need to get the government involved in my child's education? It's that kind of a scenario. But the people who are in favor of this are of the mind that this is about really protecting the kids. This is about making sure that they get their education. And this is about making sure that the parents, or this is about making sure that the kids who are being homeschooled are where their parents say they are. And it's about making sure that they are safe. Because you heard in committee, it was a very long and very contentious committee hearing, but you heard people come to the mic and tell their stories about being a homeschool student who was abused. And the abuse was able to go on for a while undetected because there weren't really standards in place. So that's kind of the angle right now. And it was really striking to me when I walked in during the homeschool rally day, because first of all, I haven't seen the Capitol hit the fire marshal code in a while. That means that it was basically one in, one out. It was kind of like a dance club, one in, one out of the Capitol for a while. But it wasn't a typical rally like you normally see. Normally, when you think of rallies, you think of chants and signs and like people kind of trying to bust down doors and make their voices heard. And there was a bit of that. There were signs, but I walked into the Capitol that day and I heard this noise and I couldn't put my finger, like, what is this noise? It sounded almost like crickets. It sounded almost kind of like night noises that were bouncing off the walls. And I'm like, I don't know what that sound is. But as I walked into the Capitol, I saw all of these hundreds of people lining the halls. And I realized these were hundreds of people watching the committee hearing on their phones. And the sound was like the tinny sound of the people talking on the phone, but just magnified by 100 times. It was so profound. And I'd never seen anything like that, but it just goes to show that this is an issue where people are really, really dug in. People are really intelligent on this issue. And it's going to take a lot of work, because I think even though it did pass committee, it passed committee on a party line vote. This is probably going to be one of those bills that's so-called held on second, meaning that they're going to hold it on second reading in the House so that it can't go any further until they work with all the stakeholders more and until they make some more changes.
Interesting. And Charlie, I guess when I look at this, I always think to myself, you know, take a look at public schools and you see, and you'll talk to any teacher or administrator, they feel the government at times is too heavy-handed on some of the rules and restrictions. So I understand this point too, that, hey, we don't need to do a ton of paperwork and all of this to homeschool our kids. At the same point, Alex brought up some of the reasoning behind it. And it is one of those things where Illinois does not put many restrictions on homeschooled kids, and maybe there are some people who fall through the cracks.
Yeah, and as a matter of fact, the representative sponsoring the bill, Glen Ellyn Democrat Tara Costa Howard, said, and this is her quote, "Currently, Illinois has zero, I'm going to say it again, zero regulations. 38 states have regulations. Illinois is an outlier. This is not something we want to be an outlier on." And part of the impetus behind this move was an investigation and a report that came out from ProPublica and Capital News Illinois last year that discovered little accountability for parents who homeschool and take their kids out of the public school and say, well, I'm going to teach Johnny at home, and then don't do it. And in some instances, the investigation found children were abused at home, and it was not noticed because they weren't in school, and there was nobody to notice that Johnny had a black eye because his dad got mad at him. And so that's the argument on the side that we should have some oversight of what's going on there. But the thing that struck me, and back in my days as a reporter, you didn't have the ability, obviously, to register online your feelings about a bill with a committee. There were more than 40,000 witness slips filed opposing the bill. That means 40,000 people took the time to go online and tell the House committee, we're opposed to this bill. And on the other hand, there were roughly 1,000 people filed in support of it. So this is one of the more polarizing issues, if you will, or one of the more controversial issues that the legislature has faced in a long time.
Yeah, that type of number will get lawmakers' attention for sure. Something else getting attention right now is mass transit in the Chicago area. Alex, you've been putting some time in reporting on this. There are some real concerns that I guess what we like to call a fiscal cliff could be coming. What's happening there?
Yeah, we sure do love talking about fiscal cliffs in Illinois, don't we? And I think that this thing with the Regional Transportation Authority in Chicago is not really on a whole lot of people's radar right now outside of Chicago. Typically, when we talk about state things, we like to talk about things that affect the whole state of Illinois. So like Chicago specific things, I don't really focus much on. But this really does have the potential to put a wrench in the budget at a time when lawmakers really can't have those kinds of wrenches. The RTA says that there is a roughly $770 million fiscal cliff that is coming up next fiscal year, which for them is January of 2026. And if they're being honest, they would really like $1.5 billion from the state, because that would not only avert the fiscal cliff, but it'll let them go into some of the improvements that they've been talking about for a long time, like universal fares, like 6-minute headways on buses, 8-minute headways on trains, that kind of thing. The question right now is, how does that happen? Because there are some lawmakers that run transportation committees that have been shouting from the rooftops as long as I can remember that the RTA needs reform. Until we see that, we're not going to agree to give you any more money. So there is one piece of legislation that I think they're loosely calling the MMA Act, the Metropolitan Mobility Authority Act. And that would take all of the service boards, Metro, Chicago Transit Authority, PACE, and it would merge them under one umbrella. That would put a lot into the idea of shared governance. It would put a lot into the idea of what's the word I'm looking for? Efficiency, of course. That word is always hard to come up with. But the transit agencies, as you might imagine, don't necessarily like that, because they think that the service boards are fine the way they are. They know their customers, they know their areas, and they know the people they serve. So it doesn't make sense to combine it into one agency and lose all of that. They think that the idea is to invest and make it better. So the other idea that's kind of floating around right now is the Road Usage Act. And that's the thing that we have been hearing about, because that would affect the entire state. And actually, much to the chagrin of the transit agencies, it's been getting a little more attention, because this is the thing that would charge you to use your car by the mile instead of charging you to use your car by how much gas you buy. And this is particularly important because of the proliferation of electric vehicles. State officials have been trying to figure out for a while how to recoup this. And now they're trying to do it under the guise of, we need to do this to help fund mass transit. So essentially, IDOT would be allowed to set up a pilot program that would allow about 1,000 vehicles to participate in this, so they could see, you know, how would this work? It's basically a completely different proposal, but both are out there. And then the RTA just came out recently and said, well, we're going to have our own proposal. So I'm going to be waiting for that. But here's the bottom line. The transit agencies say if they don't get more money, at least if they don't get money to avert the fiscal cliff, then you're going to start to see 40% service cuts as early as January. And what that means is no weekend service on PACE. So suburban bus service is gone on the weekends. One train per hour on Metro lines. Like, most Metro lines are run by the freight companies. They'd probably have to cut down to one train per hour. And then it'd be really hard to get those schedules back, because they'd have to renegotiate with the freight lines every time that happens. Bus lines, CTA warns that if bus service gets cut the way that they are going to need to, it's going to be smaller than the bus system in Madison, Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. L stations, about 50 of them would be closed. So they are really turning up the heat, and in a way that I don't think I've quite seen. I don't think I've quite seen the RTA be so forceful about what could happen, and they're very serious about it. Problem is, they need to have fiscal certainty by the end of May, which is when lawmakers adjourn, and that's 2 months from now. There's not a whole lot of clear consensus on how to move forward yet.
Yeah, and I will say I'm a fan of both the CTA, Metra. I have taken those. I think if you're one of those people who don't like to drive in the city, maybe you're not from the city, learn how to get around on mass transit. It does make things a whole lot easier. Charlie, you grew up in the south suburbs there. You grew up in Joliet and worked in Chicago. A lot of people from pretty far out take mass transit into the city. This would really have a devastating impact if there were some big cuts.
Oh, yeah. The RTA said that there also be ripple effects, they say, on the broader economy. Roughly 3,000 transit workers would be laid off. The Chicago area could lose, the RTA's estimate is $2.6 billion in gross domestic product due to increased congestion and job loss. And the transit leaders want the legislature to keep this, what they call a nightmare scenario, in mind. As they say, we need the money. And I heard a quote from one of them that we don't have an organizational problem. This is a financial problem. And so the organization structure is fine. We just need more money. And they've been various ideas floated. I think a couple of the good government groups said, well, maybe what we need to do is impose a tax on services, extend the sales tax from goods to include services and use that money to help fund mass transit. And one of the things that I don't think has been mentioned very much is there also, I'm sure, will be some kind of a buy-in or some kind of a sweetener added for mass transit outside the Chicago region, outside the RTA, for like local bus services, for example, here in Springfield or in the Metro East. From my experience, if I'm a downstate lawmaker and I'm going to vote for something that I see is helping the Chicago area, I want to have something to be able to tell my constituents, many of whom may wish that Chicago were not part of Illinois. Well, here's what we're getting from this. So we're not giving them a handout. We're getting something back. So I think that's going to be an interesting part of the whole bargaining that's going to go on. But I think the bottom line is there is going to be some kind of organizational structure to do away with these little fiefdoms for better, coordination among the schedules, for more uniform fare structure, and things that would improve service. And one of the issues some legislators have is, how are you going to make the CTA safer? How are you going to stop people doing drugs, people accosting other people, that kind of thing? How are we going to get better security on the CTA, and how are we going to get the stations cleaner? And all that is part of the overall discussion, I believe.
Okay, well, we'll watch for that as well. Just a couple of minutes left here. Real quick, Alex, maybe give us just an update on a couple of pieces of legislation. One of those, gambling legislation, wouldn't be the end of session without that. Something called internet gambling. What are we talking about?
This would be something that would allow you to basically play blackjack, roulette, poker on your phone for money with a live dealer from a land-based casino here in Illinois. That's at least that is the idea behind the legislation that's been proposed. iGaming is being floated as something, once again, to help state coffers. And essentially, yeah, some major casino owners are for this because they believe that if they are able to control iGaming, as is proposed in the legislation, that's going to drive traffic to them because they're going to be able to advertise in-app and they're going to be able to convince them to come to the casino. However, some other casinos that have been around for a while, who have been losing money for the last 10 years because of the expansion of gambling statewide, don't necessarily want this. People who run video gaming terminals in places like Springfield, who help pay for the road fund, don't want this because they think it's going to cannibalize their revenue. Mm-hmm. So this is another one of those bills that has been talked about a lot, but its path forward right now is unclear.
And just a few seconds, but something called no-knock warrants. People may not be familiar with that. There's legislation that involves these. What are we talking about and what's going on?
So this was born from Anjanette Young in Chicago. She was the victim of a no-knock warrant in 2019 by Chicago police, but they had the wrong address. And when they busted into her home, she was getting ready for bed and in a very compromising position. So they handcuffed her and she was on the floor naked for hours. And that kind of kicked off the call for reform. But she's been trying for years at the city level and the state level. And what's being proposed here would not ban no-knock warrants, but it would put some parameters in place. For example, it sets when police can serve no-knock warrants, how long they have to wait before going in, how they have to announce themselves, what they need to be visibly wearing, who can be detained, and in what manners do children, or like, can children be detained, and things like that. So there's a bunch of stuff in the bill that passed committee, that's moving forward. And Anjanette Young testified in committee, and her bottom line was, I want the police to be able to do their jobs, but I also want to make sure that they do their jobs in a way that's not going to harm me, in a way that I'm also protected.
In the case of Anjanette Young, the Chicago Police Department sergeant who oversaw the raid was fired, and Young herself reached a $2.9 million settlement with the city because of the abuse she suffered.
Let's go to our notes from the field. Charlie, we'll start with you.
Well, so far we've been talking about legislation that's kind of moving ahead. One of the things that did not get out of committee at the deadline last week was one of Governor Pritzker's top legislative initiatives, namely to allow community colleges to offer 4-year bachelor's degree programs in certain high-demand career fields. The committee chair decided not to call the bill for a vote in committee because of the controversy. The bill was opposed primarily by 4-year colleges who don't want community colleges offering some of the same things that they offer. And their argument was, particularly for some of the regionals, like Chicago State or Northeastern Illinois, that they would attract students away from the 4-year institutions, which are already facing all kinds of problems. And I think the regional universities like Eastern and Western were also very concerned about this. And the bottom line is that the colleges and universities have enough clout that they were able to put a brick on Pritzker's plan.
And Alex.
I just thought it was really interesting to note that at least as of this taping, Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson is on a political trip this weekend to St. Louis. He's going down to campaign for incumbent mayor Tashara Jones, who is, not doing very well in the polls right now. She came in second in a four-way ranked choice primary, but she lost by, more than 30 points to her top challenger, Kara Spencer, right now. So I thought the decision to send Brandon Johnson, who is from Chicago, and living in St. Louis for 6 years, I know how some people in St. Louis feel about Chicago. So not only do you have an incumbent Chicago mayor coming to St. Louis to campaign for St. Louis mayor, but Brandon Johnson's also very unpopular right now. His approval rating is literally in the toilet. So you have a really unpopular mayor from Chicago going to campaign for a really unpopular mayor in St. Louis. And I want to be in the room when that discussion was happening.
All right, that's all the time we have for this episode of State Week. Our panel included Charlie Wheeler and Alex Degman with WBEZ and Illinois Public Radio. Look for State Week where you get your podcasts through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford, and join us next time.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capitol by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.